Today is February 21st, 2012, and this interview is for the Washington County Museum. My name is Dana Williams, and I am here with Mr. William Walker at his home in Beaverton, Oregon. So, Mr. Walker, if you could just start by saying your full name, your date of birth, and place of birth.
I'm William D. Walker. Most people know me as Bill, and I was born, I'm a hillbilly. I was born down in the Ozark Mountains in South Missouri near the Arkansas border, and I went to school there, went to school through grade school in a little one-room schoolhouse in South Missouri, and through high school in a small high school, and how far do you want me to go with all of this? Because that sort of takes me through high school. Graduated from high school when I was 16. And then the question was, what shall I do? And through some contacts I had, I found that I could get a few college hours and pass the state teacher's examination and could begin to teach in those little rural schools in South Missouri. So for the next 3 years, I taught in little small rural schools. All of those I taught in had 8 grades and 2 teachers. So I'd teach either the 1st through the 4th grade or I'd teach the 5th through the 8th grade during those times. So I did that for 3 years. Found that it was going to be very slow ever getting a college degree, going in the summers and teaching in the winters, and so I decided that I would take advantage of going to the end of the Air Force. The Korean War was raging. There was some question of whether I would be eligible for the draft, but I decided I would go ahead and enlist in the Air Force, and out of that I would get the GI Bill, and that would help me finish college, pay my way through college. So when I went in, for some reason I had seen the word somewhere and it listed some interests, and I said, well, radar sounds interesting, so I wrote that down, and guess what, they sent me off to electronics school. And while I was going to electronics school in Keesler Air Force Base, Biloxi, Mississippi, I saw my first Tektronix oscilloscope. One of the instructors rolled the scope out and pulled the sides off of it and showed us how it was built, and it was the most beautiful instrument I'd ever seen. If you are involved in electronics or almost anything, you will see that they're made in a very functional way. But this wasn't only made functionally, it was beautiful, literally beautiful. The components were mounted on ceramic strips with little silver notches. They were laid in beautifully in each strip as they should be. The cables on it were all hand-laced and lay in perfect space. And the outside of it was anodized. And it was just a beautiful instrument. I couldn't believe it. And I found out that was built in Oregon, and my wife's family had just moved to Oregon, and I said, when I get out of here, when I finish college, I'm going to work for that company. So that's the way it all happened.
How were the Tektronix oscilloscopes used in the Korean War?
Well, they were used not only, they weren't used particularly for the war, but they were used for all the backup electronics. They were used heavily in the television industry and radio industry, but also, of course, the military had electronics like radar and things like that, so they were used in measurements that had to be made for the military and radar. Although the military market was a big market, it was not by any means the primary market. The primary market were companies like IBM and RCA and General Electric and the big companies that were building home electronics. But nonetheless, yes, the military did buy a lot of them. I was born in the Ozarks in 1930, which makes me 81 years old now, at the time of this interview.
And where in the Ozarks? What was the town?
The town was near the town. It was actually in the country about 5 miles from the closest town. And the closest town was Mountain View, a little town of about 500-700 people at that time. And so I went through my 8 years of grade school there in a little one-room country school, and then went to high school there for 4 years, and I graduated from high school. And then was when I started looking around at what I'm going to do, and I ended up, as I said a little earlier, in getting a few college hours, passing a state teacher's examination, and for 3 years I taught in the little small rural schools there. Then, because it seemed like I would never get my college education, getting a few hours each summer in the local college, I decided to go into the Air Force, and knew that in the long run then I would be able to get a GI Bill, which would help pay my way through college. It turns out I had the opportunity to select what I was interested in after I volunteered for the Air Force, and I saw the word radar, and that sounded interesting to me, and so I went in, went through basic, and went immediately to Keesler Air Force Base, where there was a very good electronics school. It didn't give college degrees, but it was 6 hours a day, 6 days a week. For over 6 months, you get an awful lot of classroom hours. And I'll have to say I learned my electronics there better than I really learned it when I finally did go to college and get a degree in electrical engineering. I found that the education that I got in the Air Force was gave me a very thorough understanding of how electrical and electronic products and systems worked.
So were you based in Biloxi for the entire duration of your time in the Air Force?
No, I was based in Biloxi for the six-month school. Then I took an instructor's course in instruction and stayed there for several months beyond that. And then once, to my surprise and chagrin, I saw my name posted for an overseas assignment. In Korea, but it did give me an opportunity to take one more course in New York in airborne electronics. So my wife and I and little 2.5-month-old baby moved to New York for about 3 months and took a special airborne radar course. Then I bid my little 2.5-month-old or 3-month-old, I guess, 3.5-month-old daughter at that time goodbye. And my wife, goodbye for a full year while I went and helped keep a radar set running on a very high mountain in Korea.
And that was to assist with the airborne operations?
That was to, it did two things. It was an early warning system so that we could see any planes that would come down from Korea, or as China got into the war, Korea or China, we could spot those. We could... And at the same time, we could pick up and start conversations with our own pilots as they took off from Tachikawa Air Base in Japan or the air base in Seoul. And we could direct them, our operators then could give them directions, vector them into an intercept pattern for those planes that were coming down and dropping bombs on us along the main line of resistance across the center of Korea. So I spent a year there. And keeping, helping many other people keep the radar sets running. And then that year was over and I came back and went, got reassigned to a radar site on the East Coast. And on the tip end of Virginia that sticks way down on the outside of the Chesapeake Bay, and we were right at the end of the peninsula and with 100-foot radar towers and guiding the planes and also watching for any planes that shouldn't be there. So I stayed there and I finished out and had with my wife and daughter, and then we came home and started college in Missouri. And I picked was then called the Missouri School of Mines and Metallurgy. And I knew it was a good school, but I didn't know how good it was. It is by far the best. It's now called the University of Science and Technology, University of Missouri Science, School of Science and Technology, and is really, in my opinion, the best technical college in the Midwest. It just is. It's a terrific school, and we have lots of good engineers all here along the West Coast that I meet with fairly regularly that are alumni from there. So I was in a hurry by this time because I already have a baby daughter, and it's time for me to start settling down somewhere and making a living. 4 years in the Air Force, now 3 years of college. And so I really hustled. I went summer and winter and every break, and I finished my four-year college education in about 3.5 years. Then because my wife's family were in Oregon, and because I knew Tektronix was in Oregon, I tried to get a job at Tektronix, but I couldn't. They were quite small at the time, and they wouldn't pay my way out for interviews and moving expenses and all of that. So I took a job with Boeing in Seattle and worked for Boeing 6 months until I could get a chance to interview at Tektronix. Then interviewed at Tektronix and came on down and went to work for Tektronix, which is where I really wanted to end up. And I've been associated with them. Was associated with them all together for about 42 years, but that counted not only my period of time working as an engineer and then in the management chain and then eventually on the board of directors.
Were there people at your university in Rolla that encouraged you into the Tektronix kind of route, or was that something that you had been set on since the Air Force?
Yes, that's something that I made up my mind about, that I was going to go and get the college education, and Missouri School of Mines and Metallurgy was a really good place to do it. And I came from Missouri, so I had relatives and some support system there. But beyond that, I also knew that Lou's family was out here, and so there were two things that drew me to Oregon. One was that the company I really wanted to go to work for was Tektronix, and her family was out here, and it was about time after 4 years in the Air Force and 3 years more in college to let her be somewhere near her family for a change, let them see our new grandbaby. So,
would you like some coffee?
Yes, that would be lovely. Thank you.
Would you like a cup too?
So, was it difficult? You said it was a small company at the time. Was it difficult to get that interview? Were you in contact with people before you left?
I had written to the head of engineering, Bill Politz. But I got a letter back first time. I did that when I was a junior and trying to get a summer job here. I thought, well, maybe I can get a summer job here. And I got a letter back, not from him, but by someone in personnel that said that Tektronix didn't pay for transportation to and from, and it wouldn't be worth me trying to come out on my own and work that summer. And besides, they mostly hired just Oregon boys. And I do mean boys. Weren't many girl engineers in those days. But so I didn't get to come out for for any of my summer times. And when I was graduating, and I wrote Bill Politz and the personnel people that I had gotten some names that I could write to at Tektronix. They didn't even answer my letter. So I took a job at Boeing in Seattle and said, I'm going to interview at Tektronix first chance I get. I came home one night, tired and dirty, not real dirty, because it was an engineering job at Boeing, but tired and not wanting to do anything else. And
do you take anything in it?
A little sugar and cream, thank you.
Okay.
And my wife, who was always looking out for me, said, Bill, there's a recruiter from Tektronix in town in Seattle. You've got to go down and see him. I said, Lou, I am tired. I'm too tired. I don't want to mess with it tonight. She said, yes, you've been wanting to do that. Yes, you've been wanting to do that. So get busy and get down there. So I went down there tired and not necessarily not looking my best. Didn't put a tie on or anything like that. And went to the hotel, the Olympic Hotel, and went up to the hotel room, and I remember it very distinctly because I knocked on the door, and the door swung open, and here this guy, his name was Earl Scott, said hello to me, and then as I started to step in, he just whirled around and right in my face said, what is the second integral of acceleration? So I thought quickly, and I said distance. So we were off and running with the interview. That was the right answer. And we were off and running with the interview, and said I got a job offer. But now he was not head of engineering, he was head of manufacturing. So instead of coming into engineering, I came into manufacturing. And my first job was in pre-production engineering, and it was to look at the new products coming in and make sure that the engineers had done a good job getting them ready to be manufactured. But it's one thing for an engineer to make one, it's something else to get everything set up so you can manufacture them by the dozens or hundreds or thousands. And frankly, the engineers weren't doing a very good job at that. They sort of brought it to manufacturing, and then the engineer would come over and kind of help him figure out how to do and set up parts lists and set up pricing lists and all the stuff you have to do to build not one but hundreds.
How much would you like?
They're in that manufacturing thing. This was really my first real contribution at Tech. This is awful. And so I got a little bit of permission to do something from the manufacturing manager to do something to help us get those products that were coming, new products that were coming out of being introduced out of engineering so that we could build them. And I got hired, two other guys, and I was kind of the lead guy for this little three-person group. And we started taking a new instrument whenever engineering bring it over, and we would start going through it thoroughly, and then we'd go back to engineering and say, we don't have this and this and this and this and this, and begin to make up the list of stuff. And then I create, so I said, well, you know, we have to have, we need a process that's a consistent process that covers what's needed to bring a product from engineering to manufacturing. So I created, out of my own brain, a thing that we called, end up calling the phase system. So we said, okay, first phase is the engineers have designed this thing. Second phase is they bring us to bring it over to manufacturing. During that phase, we will do an evaluation on it, see whether or not we know how to manufacture it. We have all the stuff, all the information. Whether or not we have all of the information that we need to manufacture it, and if not, get that information out of engineering and make sure the manufacturing has it. That will be phase B, and then phase C will be when we actually introduce it into the manufacturing process, once we know all that's done. So we have this phase system, and now we know. And we set up standards. So, okay, as they come out of engineering, it has to have all of this kind of stuff in it. Now, we take a good look at the manufacturability of it and say, okay, now we have to have all of this done before we can manufacture it. And then it go into manufacturing and what we would watch it for a certain period of time and it would be done. So the phase system became the standard thing. They still use that phase system over there. They have no idea who started it, but now... But they still call it the phase system, and we put out a little publication each month that said where every new product was in the phase system, what had been done, what hadn't been done. We called it the phase angle, and they still call that the phase angle. They still put that thing out, and they still run it right through the same process. This is like 30, 40 years later. That was probably my best contribution into the kind of the engineering manufacturing interface effort, and out of that I did build myself a group a small manufacturing organization. Then I sort of accumulated the other manufacturing engineering things that were in existence in the different parts, like out in the metals parts or in the unit wiring parts or over in the components. And Tektronix was very integrated. They built literally every part that they used practically. So it was very integrated, and I got the system going for all of that and built this fair-sized group that simply worked at the whole introduction process all the way through to the pricing. And it was a very good group. And eventually the order came down from on high, what was on high then, that says, we're gonna have to coordinate these two things that's going on over here, because by now we're doing a lot of the engineering, plus the design engineering organization will put them all together, and they did that. And so they moved my organization over into the engineering rather than leaving it in manufacturing, because I had a bunch of really good engineers, and we were doing all of the finish up all of the engineering work on every product. So I moved over to the engineering group and reported to Vice President of Engineering, Bill Politz, wonderful guy. And I continued to work for him, but as I did that, and as the company grew larger and the processes grew a little bit more complex, I sort of just bypassed him, and he worked for me instead of me working for him. And as I kept all my old group plus my new plus all of his group plus a couple of others that at that time were not so connected. One of the two other things I had done meantime, I had started an advanced products group, which were working on advanced products because they had to get started somewhere and they weren't getting started, and I just did that, and I could get away with it, and I did. And then in addition to that, I had started an integrated, what's called integrated circuit group, because I had started hearing about this guy down in Arizona by the name of Glenn Madlin that knew how and would teach you how to make an integrated circuit. Now that's instead of making circuits out of resistors and capacitors and vacuum tubes or transistors and all of those things and running wires between them. This was a way to make them all in a process on a little small chip. And this seemed to me has to be the way things are going to be going. So I went down to Arizona and sat through Glenn Madlin's course, and he taught us how to do it, how to cut ruby lith, make out patterns. So you make out this huge pattern as big as a wall, which then gets photographically shrunk and then photographically imposed on a small chip, and you can make things like that beautiful little instrument there instead of being that big or that big. And when I learned how to do it, then I had him come up and teach a group of Tektronix how to do it, and we started our own integrated circuit labs and built our own circuits for it. Well, in doing these things, you just kind of, you gain a lot of influence in the company, and so eventually I gained so much influence that I ran a big piece of Tektronix, still reporting to Earl Wantland, who at that time was the CEO. So what came after that? What came after that, Lou? I don't know.
Howard asked you to run, was it before or after that, that he asked you to take charge of all product planning?
Oh, yes. I guess that was the next thing. I was so involved in that product planning stuff, and I had this system that was working, the phase system and all, that Howard asked me to be in charge of product planning, which was, like handing me a big club to do the things that I wanted to do, because by planning the process, I could get right into the process, the engineer's process, and basically force the engineering group and the engineering vice president and all of them to move that product along through a very consistent process to bring it into manufacturing. And as the more I did that, and the more I saw which products we really ought to be building, the more I made inputs and said, we ought to be building these new products, we ought to be building this where we need to do, and this where we need to do, and we have these new integrated circuits. And frankly, Howard Vollum and I became pretty darn close, and he liked what I was doing a lot, and he was getting done the kinds of things he was really interested in getting done, and was getting that done through me, and so I became kind of the runner of all the engineering and the new product operation in total. And I became vice president of engineering then, and went on to become chief operating officer of the company. And during that time, I had started a new operation inside of Tektronix called Tech Development Company, because we had so many creative people and they were leaving the company to start their own companies. And I reasoned that if we would put together a development company, a Tektronix development company, and the people that are in tech that really are wanting to do this, we would help them go out and start their own company. But in order for us to help them and allow them and and make it easy for them to do that, we would own half the company. We wouldn't own quite half. We'd own only 49%. They would own 51%. And then we would help finance the new company. We would help get the proper equipment because we had so much at Tektronix, and we'd help them get going. So that feeds into the whole Silicon Forest kind of an idea. Tech was just loaded with guys who were creative and wanted to do things and would love to do this sort of thing. So now they had a vehicle that they could come to the tech development company and say, here, I want to do this. Like Jim Hurd and Chris King, they came to me one day and said, I remember them specifically because I did a lot of, they became Planar. They said, that we have this idea, we know how to build a flat panel, and we know how to address it, and we can build, instead of an oscilloscope that looks like one of the picture of the oscilloscope in there, we can build one with a flat panel in it, or we can build displays for other things out of this flat panel, and we can address it. And we would like to spin out, and we'd like to take some of the equipment with us that we've been using in the basement to work on it. So I sat down with them and said, okay, here's the deal, you know. We'll help you spin it out, and you can take the equipment with you, and we will help you with the startup expense, but we'll own 49% of the company. So whenever you get successful and go public and sell the company or let it go public, we'll get our money back. So that's what I did, and that Tektronix Development Company continued, and we spun several companies out into this Silicon Forest around here through that. Because our really good creative engineers were going to go somewhere and do something, and this gave us a chance to have a part in it and make some money out of it, and gave them a lot of help because they didn't have then to go out and get bank loans and do all the stuff that you would otherwise have to do to get a small company started. So that became the Tektronix Development Company, and that really helped a lot to seed this valley with small companies.
How did Tektronix, do you think, prepare those individuals for running their own business and for starting their own business?
Well, Tech didn't do anything overtly for that purpose. It was a pretty much learn as you go thing for the people who wanted to start a new business. They had to get busy and make sure they understood enough about business that they had a chance to succeed. But I would put in here that there were enormous number of classes of Tektronix of almost every kind that you can think of. We were running at that time, at our peak, and at that time we were running a bigger operation than Oregon State in terms of classes. We had an enormous educational program. I wish I still had a book to show you all the courses you could take at Tektronix. Tektronix people, you know, there would be a tech guy who was very good in some field, and he would be, one of his jobs was to spend a few hours a week teaching classes. And we had everything from classes in basic electronics up to classes in how to make integrated circuits. So we even had classes on learning to fly if you wanted to happen to want to fly an airplane, because I took one of those.
Did Mr. Ballen teach that class?
No. He didn't teach any classes at all. This was done by engineering guys and technical people, or marketing. Sometimes marketing people would have a class going in marketing, and sometimes it would be someone who, out of human resources, it would have one going in organization management and how you do training. all kinds of different things. We had a catalog that thick that was full of courses that people could take. It was a wonderful opportunity to learn, to move on up the ladder. There were all kinds of people went there. Do you know who Jane All was?
I don't.
You don't know who Jane All was? Well, she's a writer who wrote a series of books which became bestsellers and movies were made of them. The initial book she wrote was Clan of the Cave Bear, and she wrote it while she was working at Tektronix. Very, 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 very bright woman. Classes were available that you could learn a lot of different skills. Tech was a very wide open company. It was an amazing company. Mm-hmm. And it started from simple things like, I didn't have an office. Howard Vollum didn't have an office. If it was just a wide open floor that just stretched for several hundred feet, and there were desks out there, and there sat Howard Vollum, and if somebody from way down in this 20,000 person organization wanted to talk to Howard Vollum, all they had to do was walk up the stairs and walk out to his desk and tap him on the shoulder and do that. And people didn't abuse it, you know. They usually went. We had very good communication system. We had every area. We didn't never had a union. Unions tried many times to come in there, but they could never get anywhere. Employees didn't need them, didn't want them. We had a area rep system, so that every area. How often, every 3 or every 6 months, would elect a representative from their area, and this representative from their area would go to a big area rep meeting every month, and all the people in there, anything that they didn't like, including my feet get cold, or I don't like the lunches that are served, or the coffee's awful, or whatever it was, that area rep would bring that list of issues in. And so there would be a big room full of 50 or so area reps from all over the company. And someone like me, or Howard Vollum, or Earl Wantland, or Bill Pulitz, or whoever turn it was, would stand up in front of those area reps and take the guff they had to give out and answer their questions in person. And if we didn't have an answer, they'd ask about why is this done somewhere, and I said, well, I didn't know it was. I'll find out about it, and then we would give them a written, we'll get written answers. And so every month there would be a area rep sheet came out that had all the answers from the management for the issues we had. So it was a very open company, an honest company. I've never met anyone more honest than Howard Vollum. I mean, he wouldn't shade anything. On a picture of a, on the front panel of a, I don't think I have a tech catalog up here. I brought everything except that. But on the front of a tech catalog, if he had a picture of an oscilloscope with a trace that ran across it like they do, he wouldn't let you touch up that trace. He said, if people look at that and they think it's a picture, they ought to see it as it is. If it's a little too dim and you don't like it, that's the way it is, and you'll show it just like it is. Total honesty was just an innate kind of a policy with him. He couldn't be dishonest. What else was there about him? But I guess what I'm saying, all of those things that I'm saying about Tektronix, to a very heavy degree, moved out into this Silicon Forest. Because those guys that went out and started companies, most of them started companies that ran on those same kinds of principles. Open offices, open communication lines, basically operated on a system of trust rather than some other system. So the Silicon Forest became true almost they truly had the DNA of Tektronix in them, and almost any of them would tell you that. After Intel came in, there were a few. Intel had a few spinoffs, but which were a little different. Sequent, I think, was an Intel spinoff, and that were a little different. But the Tech spinoffs nearly all operated pretty much the same way Tech did.
So, one of the spinoffs that you spoke about earlier was Planar. How did you personally get involved with Planar, and when did you start working for them? And what was your role?
Well, the dates has probably escaped me. I could make some guesses at it, but I just told you we had started this thing called the Tektronix Development Company, and that helped with the spinoff. Well, Chris King and Jim Hurd came and said we would like to spin out. So this was maybe not the first one, but the first one that became a really large company like that. And so I, as I said, basically said the rule was that we would own 49% of it and we would help them do it. And I don't remember whether they asked me or whether I insisted on it, but at any rate, there would be a couple of members from Tektronix on the on their board of directors immediate as well. And so that's the way it happened. They started the company and I was on the board of directors, and as they got rolling and the business decisions that had to be made, questions that came up and all of that, eventually Jim Hurd, who was the president and chairman of the board, came to me and asked if I, he said, you know, you're on the board, Bill, would you become our chairman? You do that, relieve me of that, and I'll go ahead and be the president and chief executive officer of the company, but will you take the role of chairman? And I said, yes, I'll do that. And I did, and helped them where I could as they rolled into a very successful company. Then eventually Jim Hurd got leukemia. He came. He asked me to have a drink after work with him, and I did. And he said, Bill, I've got leukemia. And I said, well, Jim, there are doctors and medications and there are things they can do. And he said, not this one. It's not one they can fix. So we talked a lot about it, and sure enough, it went on and got bad. And so I took over running the company then as president. Until we could get another CEO. So that was why Jim's leukemia was why I came in there as CEO for a year until we could get someone. And we ended up getting Krishnamurthy, Balaji Krishnamurthy, to come in behind me. It didn't work out as well as it should. I don't care if that's on the record. As well as I'd hoped, I should say. Just didn't work out. It didn't fit. So anyway, the other thing about Tech was that I think is important is how international it became as a company. We had manufacturing on Guernsey Island in the British-English Channel. And that was put in because of tax problems. That was kept us from having a manufacturing tax, and we built and distributed from there to all of the British Commonwealth tax-free, because Guernsey was a tax-free entity. And so we kept that plant for many years. The other one that we did similar to that was we put one in Netherlands and Heerenveen, Holland, and that was so we could manufacture inside the common market, what was called the common market, which was all the rest of Europe, Western Europe. So we built those two things just purely for tax purposes. Earl Wantland, who later became our CEO, really got his start running the plant in Holland, and then came back over after that and became president of Tektronix. We also had field operations, selling and in almost all cases selling and service operations all over the world, Australia, and South Africa, Europe, just literally all over the world. We had service and sales operations, so we're very worldwide kind of a company in that respect. Another one of those that was interesting of that type, Howard Vollum had been to Japan, and he found that he liked a lot of things about the Japanese people. He liked the simplicity of life, just a lot of things about them. And in his visit over there, he contacted the Sony people, and he found that he really liked Mr. Morita and Mr. Ibuka, the people who had started Sony and were running them, and they talked about it. And we had a distributor that basically a sales operation in Japan, and but he and Morita talked about what they could do together, and so basically they decided on a small, very very small, very portable instrument, which Sony seemed very good at doing that kind of thing, that would be made in Japan. And we put together a joint venture operation in Japan, the outskirts of Tokyo in Japan. And so I, in the course of my career, I became the Tektronix board member to that group, so I was in and out of Japan a lot with these guys, and got to know them really well. The two founders of Sony, Mr. Morita and Mr. Ibuka, I got to know very well. And, they're wonderful gentlemen to do business with. They were all business, and they were very Japanese. Mr. Ibuka, he always wore a long Japanese robe and what I call ghost slippers, the little thing between his big toes, and was very traditional Japanese. Mr. Morita had come early to the United States to help Sony get established in this market. So he spent 10 years in New York getting Sony off and running and with their business in the U.S. So he was much more Western American, confrontive, open personality kind of person.
How did the business climate or relationships within the business change as it grew to be international?
It made the jump to international really, really well. We had we had good people at the head of that. Don Alvey became international manager. He was a British guy in the marketing organization over there, and he became international manager. And he was married to a girl from Guernsey Island, and I think that was the influence, probably, if we really knew it, that influenced us to go put a manufacturing operation on Guernsey. Guernsey's not very big. It's in the middle of the English Channel. It's about 5 miles all the way around it. And the saying over there was that Guernsey is nothing but tourists, tomatoes, and Tektronix. And that those were the main thing. Tourists went there, of course, and they had huge what do you call them? Hotbeds with glass covers that raised tomatoes. Huge amount of Guernsey was covered with these glass, low glass platform things that they grew tomatoes in. They started really early and they furnished the European market with tomatoes. So, tomatoes, Tektronix. And I'm sure we were there because Don Halvey, our international manager's wife, was from Guernsey. But it worked out well. It was a good place for tax purposes, and it had some practical things with it. The Sony Tech thing was a very, very good way for us to address the Far East, and Sony was a very good partner with us. We had operations everywhere.
How did your international travel for the company change your perception of Tektronix's role in the high-tech industry?
Well, you know, that's an interesting story because it wasn't my international travel. I was sitting in a staff meeting, Bill Politz's staff meeting, when I was still reporting to Bill Politz, who was head of engineering. Yeah, well.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, we were sitting in a staff meeting, Bill Politz's staff meeting, and Norm Winningstead started sort of pounding the table, said, we've got to do something. There is a group being put together that's setting international standards for electronic measurement products. They're going to set these international standards. And they're doing it partially so that they can use non-tariff barriers to keep us out of certain places where they have competitive products. We've got to get in on this and make sure they can't get these standards set so that we can't sell our products in France and Germany and other places. So this was Winningstead, and then he said, and I'm busy and I've got this and this and this going and I can't do it and somebody's going to have to do it. And nobody said anything, so finally I peeped up and said, well, I'll do it. So that began my sub-career as a member of a thing called International Electrotechnical Commission, IEC, and it was a group put together to bring about standardization of a lot of things having to do with instrumentation and electronic equipment generally. So that they met everywhere in the world. They met in London, they met in Prague, they met in Helsinki, they met in Leningrad, they met all over the world. And so I started, because I started going to those meetings, and very quickly I became chairman of the oscilloscope, the Committee on Oscilloscopes, and then I became chairman eventually of the whole electronic instrument piece of it. But that caused me to have to go to these meetings which were held in all of the different parts of the world, which was a great thing for me. It was wonderful to go to Prague and have people who were on the committee from Prague there to take you to dinner, tell you where to eat, tell you where to stay, and be the host and so forth. And I did that in Helsinki and Prague and Rome and Leningrad and Paris several times, London, and Tokyo. So it was a good thing to do. It was a good thing I was on it, and I eventually, as I said, I became chairman of all the committees that had anything to do with our type of instrumentation, and could make sure that we were not barred from places that we didn't want to be, and on top of that, push for standards which were the way that we did things, which made it a little easier for us all the way around. It was a good thing for Tektronix, and I think it was a good, really good thing all the way around. Good standardization of things that needed some standards. But it was a very good, always told people this is my best boondoggle that I ever got in my whole working career, that I took that job because Winningstead said he was too busy. And I really got to influence a lot of things, so it was a good thing, but also it was a lot of fun, and I met a lot of people from a lot of different countries that worked in the high-tech industry.